rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. This is the petition of Amanda Jane Wolf versus the Secretary. Case number 18-6091. With me are Judges Allen and Falvey. This being the application of the Secretary, and I believe counsel has been advised, the Secretary will argue first, and the petitioner's counsel, and if you intend to reserve any time, let us know. So we'll have the appearances of counsel entered on the record, please. Petitioners first.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Blocker for the petitioners and the class.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Bart Stitchman.
John Niles.
Mr. Blocker, you're arguing. Secretary.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christopher Bader from the Secretary. With me at counsel table are Deborah Pinal, my co-counsel, Joan Moriarty, and Deputy Chief.
Thanks very much. Government, proceed.
Your Honor, if I may reserve 5 minutes.
Fine. 5 minutes total. We're going to go through, both applications at once, right?
Yes.
Right. 5 minutes total?
Yes.
Fine.
5 minutes are arguable.
Right. Proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The Secretary plans to appeal the court's September 9th ruling, but the purpose of his recent motions is not to relitigate the merits of this case. Instead, those motions are animated by three primary concerns. First, the need for a judgment to crystallize the relief to be granted and signal that the court's decision is final. Second, the massive prejudice the Secretary would suffer if forced to carry out the court's ruling without an opportunity to exercise his right to appeal.
Haven't we heard this argument before, 2016 in the Staub case?
Your Honor, you did hear the Secretary arguing about the need for...
And didn't the then Secretary, when he was before the Senate committee, say he agreed to withdraw that appeal, even though the Secretary, presumably in good faith, filed an appeal from the final determination of the court, thought it was without merit, the decision of the court in Staub?
Yes, Your Honor. So when the Secretary sought to appeal the court's ruling in Staub, as is always required, he sought the approval of the Solicitor General to take the appeal to the Federal Circuit. The Solicitor General reviewed it and granted that request and then took the appeal to the Federal Circuit for...
Yeah, but why isn't the current Secretary bound by the decision of the prior Secretary? You get to change your mind with new secretaries? I mean, it's not a facetious question. Maybe your position is yes. We have a new secretary, we have a new position.
Our position is that the law and the facts are different in this case, and so the decision must be guided by those.
Well, what's different? We made a decision. The secretary made two applications, as I recall, in 2016 as to the financial impact of that decision and why we ought to stay our hand. They were rejected. You proceeded to the Federal Circuit, and then the Secretary got smacked around by a couple of senators, and he said, I give up. In fact, I think there's an order saying the parties have resolved their differences in Staub. So what's different about this?
Your Honor, there are a few reasons that this case is different from Staub. First, I'll make clear from the start that the Secretary does intend to appeal, and he has recommended that to the Solicitor General. So we are moving forward on that process, and that's why we're seeking this relief. You know, one of the things that you ordinarily need to appeal a decision of the court is a judgment. So that's one of the things we've asked for today. And I think, to the core of your question, I think it's important to remember that when we talk about the conduct of the Secretary that either supports or militates against a stay of proceedings or informs your judgment in this case, What happened in Staub is we litigated the case and we lost. We sought to appeal, we exercised our right of appeal, and then for various reasons withdrew the appeal. After Staub was over, as we discussed in the first oral argument, VA essentially had no regulations and no adjudicated machinery in place.
And we held already in this case that you didn't need any regulations that were in conflict with the statute.
That's true, Your Honor, but remember, before Staub, if other health insurance was present, the claim was simply denied, whether or not the other health insurance had a cost share associated with it. We had no ability to process those claims, and we had to develop those regulations. Other than the suggestion that we did not comply with the Staub court's reading of the ECFA, there's nothing about the procedural history in Staub, or in this case, that suggests that the Secretary has acted in bad faith. All he did was exercise his right of appeal, decide to withdraw that appeal for various reasons, develop regulations to comply, and then, as you found in September, did not comply with the regulations that he found.
So the two motions that the Secretary has are analytically distinct, right? In other words, you're asking to stay the precedential effect of the decision. Let's put that aside for a moment. I want to focus on the other one. There's no question in my mind that Secretary has an absolute right to appeal a final decision of the court. There's no question about that. We usually don't have an issue at all figuring out how that works because we issue a decision and we're done, right? There's usually nothing left to be done other than compliance with the decision or maybe an EJ application which doesn't abate the finality necessarily. Here we have the oddity that there is something that's left to be done because there appears to be a dispute between the parties about the adequacy of what the Secretary is doing to comply with the notice, groups A, B, C, and now we might go on in the alphabet from this. How do we balance those things? I mean, and this is a true question, it is not loaded. So we have two things that we need to do as the court, which is we now have this class action world where we're going to have some management activities afterwards, and the Secretary has a right to appeal. And we have to figure out how to allow the Secretary to appeal in a way that doesn't stretch out forever into the future, while also preserving the court's authority to manage the action. Your alternative relief is certification of an interlocutory appeal. That is, in my view, and I'll ask Mr. Blocker about this as well, a very poor substitute, because if you appeal, the Federal Circuit has to take the appeal. Done. If we certify a question, you file a petition with the Federal Circuit, and so they can say, no, we're not even going to hear the appeal. Doubt they'd do that necessarily, but they could. I would like your views about how to solve this conundrum, and if you can be helpful, both parties, in not just saying, it's my way or the highway, that would be helpful, because maybe this is a binary choice and we just have to make it. But I'm looking for some way that, not just in this case, but as we move forward, we can figure out a way to balance these two things.
Well, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. We're sort of in uncharted territory here. I think we all recognize that in the post-Funk world. And there are going to be growing pains associated with managing class litigation that this court as an appellate court maybe doesn't have all the institutional knowledge that it's going to need, and certainly it's going to be challenges the district courts don't. So I think, starting from that position that we're in uncharted waters, I'm going to go through and explain, starting with what I think the purpose of judgments are, and then talk about why I think a judgment can be issued in this case immediately. First, judgments are important in a case like this, not just to signal the start of the time to appeal, not just to start that clock, but because it crystallizes the relief to be granted and it signals that the court is finished with the case. And that's important for the court, that's important for both parties, because, you know, in a personal injury action in state court, if the plaintiff wins at trial and the jury verdict says you're granted, you know, $1,000 recovery, you can't take that verdict form to the county recorder's office and then get a lien against the defendant's house. You have to have a judgment in your hand. So the judgment says the court is done with the case, and as you mentioned, you have two options. You can comply or you can appeal. And I think when we start from that premise. And then we add in somewhat unique factor in this case is that we know that by operation of Tobler, as we discussed in our briefing, as of September 9th, 2019, our regulation no longer existed. So that means that for claims open to direct review or they're still awaiting adjudication, we should apply the law that you announced in Wolf, and we are doing that. The problem is that because there's no temporal limitation on the class stretching backward, and we believe it goes all the way back to 2010, in order to comply with the relief that you've ordered us to provide, we essentially have to violate the rule of finality of judgments, because most of those people have claims that have long since expired, whereas in SCORE, the court took pains to cut those people out of the class. So we think that a judgment is extremely important, both because of its ordinary purposes and the unique facts of this case.
Could you move to amend the order to put a temporal limit on it?
I don't think we could anymore, Your Honor, because the time to seek reconsideration has expired.
Well, you know, I'm not channeling Judge Falvey, but I think that's precisely what you should do.
Definitely not channeling me.
Yeah. Absolutely, Presiding Judge Greenberg. So, but listen, I mean, we are in unusual circumstances, right? If, in fact, we either made a mistake or inadvertently did something, right? In other words, there's a famous story of a judge who said that he was going to enter a contempt order and charge a certain amount of money each day, and then he said compounded. And then it turned out that after a month, he had ordered somebody to pay $1.5 billion, right? And of course, that's not what he meant, right? I would take the opportunity to correct an error if you think there is such an error. And we haven't entered judgment, you know that. And I think I would certainly look favorably to a motion if you think one is appropriate, because if we've got a problem in this order that we can fix to make things right, then I'd prefer to have a chance to fix it.
Well, go ahead. Answer the judge. What's your proposal? Judge Falvey asked a question. So did Judge Allen.
I appreciate those.
Assume you're here and we're listening. Got to make a decision. We're listening to you on the merits. What do you propose? What's the secretary propose as the remedy for this either alleged mistake or inadvertent error or misapprehension of the situation?
I think, Your Honor, coming from my experience as a law clerk, I would try to see what the rule-based authority was for making such a request. But if we put that to the side on the merits, I believe that it would be fully appropriate for you to limit the class definition as petitioner requested, because the finality of judgments is important. In SCORE, you made very plain that aggregate litigation procedures bring together claims that are open to direct review that are still alive, but you cannot revive a dead claim simply by lumping it in with other claims.
So, on that point, right, I mean, if that were the argument that you're making, right, I think that there are ways that one could deal with that. Now, first of all, the Secretary really didn't make those arguments in the web of briefing leading up to this. I mean, there wasn't a temporal issue in the same way. I also think that if we were going to get into that, just to foreshadow this, because like I say, if we've made a mistake, I'd prefer to correct it ourselves rather than to have the Federal Circuit say that we made a mistake, right? It's just much more efficient that way, is arguably that in SCORE, right, as you know, what we basically said was we weren't going to revive the expired claimants because this didn't match with the Social Security cases in which there was sort of a misinformation, right? On one view here, doesn't have to be negative, it doesn't have to be intentionally, right? But the Secretary was sending out letters telling people the whole time, you can't get reimbursed, right? I mean, so it's much closer, I think, to the situation in the Social Security cases. So, I mean, if that's your argument, I think you should make the argument to us. And if you want a rule-based authority, I like rules. I taught civil procedure for a long time. Rule two, right?
Suspend the rule.
There you go. It's my favorite rule because it says, yes, the rule says this, but we can do what we want because we can suspend the rule. So there, that's what I'd say for that.
Well, we'll certainly consider it. I think to respond to the point you were making just before that, which I think is still important in the argument today about the motions that are pending before you, I actually don't think that this case represents an analog to cases that talk about affirmative misrepresentations. We know, and the Secretary is happy to concede, that with respect to the Borsinger class members, we made a mistake. We told them about the law inconsistent with the decision in Staub. We made immediate efforts to correct that mistake. But other than that notable misinformation about the law, which we immediately sought to correct, before then, the law was correct. We were telling people from 2010 forward, or say 2012, when the regulation was first adopted, that the law didn't provide for the reimbursement of deductibles, coinsurance, and similar payments. That regulation wasn't challenged until 2018, so that was the law. And so I think SCORE teaches that if the law was the way it was when it was decided and you thought it was invalid, you needed to be the one to appeal. That was one of the points that I thought was very interesting from the SCORE opinion was, if it wasn't Mr. SCORE, you know, why weren't these other people with expired claims Mr. SCORE? Why didn't they take their appeal? So I think that other than for the Borsinger class members who we've sought to fix the problem that we created, I don't think that it really creates a good analogy that would mean that you can reach those people simply because the law was different back then and you've decided that it's different now. I mean, that's the same thing that happened. I mean, that is the rule of finality of judgments. If, you know, the police pull you over and beat you up on the side of the road and for some reason the Supreme Court authority says you can't recover under the Fourth Amendment, the next term they decide a case differently, but your case has already had a final judgment, that's the end of the road for you. So I don't think that those claims can be revived simply because the law has now changed.
And I know we're not here on that point today, but it actually is relevant, right? Because if, in fact, there is hypothetically or potentially slicing and dicing to do with the order, because let's just start from the presumption that perhaps one can look at SCORE as a change in the law, right? A new constant in our world of variables, so to speak. Okay, if we do that, right, then it actually does play into both your motion with respect to suspending the precedential effect of the decision and the argument with respect to immediate entry of judgment. Because if, in fact, we were going to consider a motion that wanted us to recraft some portion of this, obviously you wouldn't enter judgment at that moment because you're fixing the judgment, potentially, right? I mean, so that's why this point is relevant to the motions, I think, that you have.
I think it is, Your Honor, and I think it actually highlights one of the things that I was talking about earlier, that the purpose of a judgment is to crystallize the relief and say, we, the court, are finished with the case, and you have two options, comply or appeal. But if we're considering that maybe there are changes we need to make, that shows that although the Secretary proposed in the October 2019 Declaration of Dr. Matthews that we are undertaking good faith efforts to figure out how we would afford relief to the Wolf class members, we can't really start doing that until we know that these are the marching orders. We know, with respect to the Borsinger class, that VA sometimes makes mistakes. If we want to do this correctly, if this is what we are going to do. So, again, the purpose of a judgment is to tell us, this is what you need to be doing. You can appeal if you want, but these are the marching orders if that appeal does not work out for you.
Well, what have you done since we entered our order to advise veterans in the class that was certified that we have decided the case?
We have not sent any notices.
Why not?
Class members. For the Borsinger class, specifically, you directed us to prepare a second plan. I know that there's a suggestion that notice should go to every member of the Wolf class as well, but putting that to one side, we don't agree with that. If the plan is just about the Borsinger class, we need your approval. You told us to submit a plan.
No, why didn't you put out the word to everybody in the VA. You've got websites, you've got all kinds of means of communication with veterans, but this is the decision of the court.
Your Honor, we don't ordinarily publish the decisions. I'm sure it was in a newsletter, but we don't ordinarily send out special notices about the decisions of the court.
They're
publicly available anyway. But I will submit that for the Wolf class, as I was explaining earlier, there's sort of, as I view it, a retrospective piece where we run into the finality of judgments problem, and we think we need a judgment. But there's also this perspective piece, as I told you. Tobler says the law was, as Wolf says it is, on September 9, 2019. And we are applying that law. The board is remanding claims to be adjudicated consistent with it. For example, Mr. Staub himself has his claims pending after the March 2019 board remand, and we're ready to process those. There's a lot of information about his two hospital stays that I don't want to get into, but suffice to say there is a deductible in there, and we are going to pay it. So you can rest assured that the claims that we are processing right now are being adjudicated consistent with your decision because, again, from my law clerk days, I would tell you, you don't have a stay unless and until we give you one, and we take that very seriously. We've asked you for a stay, but we're acting in the meantime because we have to. Your Honor, there's a couple of other points that I think I should hit that I think are really important to remember, not just about the motion for judgment, but about the motion for stay. The motion for judgment, I think the other important piece here, other than maybe fixing aspects of the order that you may want to do, is that we strongly maintain that finalizing the corrective action plan 2, as we have come to call it, with respect to the board share class, is not endemic to the Wolf class relief, and therefore you can issue judgment for the Wolf class now. I fully recognize, and I appreciate petitioners pointing out that the Elkins case is not a neat analog. It's talking about disability claims coming from the agency. It's not talking about claims being litigated here. I proposed that as an analogy only because it provides a framework for appreciating, first, that the veterans' cases are litigated in a somewhat unique fashion, as we can all appreciate. And second, Elkins itself relies on Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54B, which says that judgment can be issued as to fewer than all the claims and all the parties if the court finds that it should be done, if there's good cause to do it. You can issue a judgment and let those claims proceed.
So, what do we do with the fact that Rule 2 doesn't help us with this point, right? We don't really have anything in our rules or in a statute, and that would be the particular point that would be important here, that talks about us doing something like that other than certification, right?
I think that the fact that the Federal Circuit in Elkins try to draw analogies between litigation in this court and the district courts and relied on Rule 54. I mean, just as you've relied on Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in the meantime while the proposed rules are being thought about, I think that you could rely on Rule 54.
So the problem we run into is the sort of weirdly jurisdictional problem in the sense that there is absolutely nothing in the world that we can do that can alter the Federal Circuit's jurisdiction. We can do something to turn it on, right, by issuing a judgment. Just say, judgment, right, and done. And then that turns on your right to appeal. But arguably, if we tried to separate out something and say we're going to issue a judgment, right? But just a partial judgment on this portion, and then we're going to keep the non-judgment portion and keep working. We couldn't do anything to affect the Federal Circuit, because if you appeal, the Federal Circuit's either going to say we have jurisdiction or we're not, right? But all the work that then continues down here might very well be in question, because the Federal Circuit might say, we're going to take this, but we're going to take it all because you can't slice and dice. You see what I mean?
I absolutely do. It is not an easy question. I think there are a few points to remember about the request we're making for the essentially a partial judgment or just to find that you don't need the plan at all. First, you know, I'm not going to repeat what I said in the brief. I think you all read that. But the point that I want to emphasize is that when we filed our plan in October, you know, maybe there was a time at which we could have expected all of this to be tied up neatly and quickly to then send up in one complete judgment up to the Federal Circuit. But now it has been, you know, 3 months since then, and we just received petitioner's response to the plan last week. Now they want to broaden the plan to everybody in the Wolf class. They want to have 3 or 4 more categories. They want to have deadlines and reports. It sounds like it's going to be an issue that's going to be contentious, and it's also, again, wholly separate from what Ms. Wolf and her class need to achieve relief.
Would the secretary be willing? So, you know, in SCORE, we ordered the secretary to work with that we ordered the parties to work together, the class council and secretary's council, to develop a plan of notice.
We did that here, too.
No. Here it was slightly different, right? Because, as I understand this, although the SCORE notice issue is still going, we just issued an order this morning, but the parties actually worked together quite cooperatively there. Here, the notice we ordered was actually slightly different because we had resolved the merits at the same time as we certified the class. So the notice wasn't actually notice of the class action. It was correcting notice that the secretary had done independently before, right? Okay, clearly that has not worked out well among the parties, right? What if we were to say or suggest or take that one member of the panel thinks that it might be useful to have the parties talk about this?
Your Honor, the Secretary remains happy to meet and confer to try to reach an amicable resolution. I think there are a couple of very deep-seated problems that have stood in our way thus far. The first is that, essentially, if you think about the relief that you awarded and the nature of the Forshinger class error, Your Honor, I see I'm going to run out of time.
Keep going.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you think about the Forshinger class error, it was we told veterans information that was inconsistent with STOB, and the reasoning that they needed relief was that they might not have exercised their right of appeal. So what we did was we sent them corrective notice and restarted all of their appeal periods. Now, we included a statement about deductibles and co-insurance that happened to be the law at the time we sent the notice. So we weren't allowed to say anything else. But now that you've awarded relief to the Wolf class, everyone who's affected by the failure to reimburse deductibles and co-insurance is going to receive a re-adjudication, and through that, notice and a check. So, to my mind, Your Honor, it seems like the corrective action plan, too, is not going to serve much of a function except to give those people notice now, but they're already going to get the re-adjudications by operation of their order. The other really important pieces about the second corrective action plan that I think we need to remember are this class is pretty much unlike any report we've seen before. There's over 500,000 people in this class that stretches all the way back in time. There's millions of claims at issue because, as we discussed in the last argument, one episode of care in a hospital can generate dozens of individual claims, which are often adjudicated separately because they're different providers sending in requests for reimbursement. The court has held all the way back in 8 MedApp and Cleary, they said, we don't have the authority or the responsibility to supervise, oversee the adjudicative process that results in the BVA decision. So one of the really big qualms we have about petitioner's proposal is that essentially class counsel want to step into that role by receiving reports from us, getting to insert themselves into the operations of the agency as it endeavors in good faith to comply with the order. By virtue of suing the government, class counsel did not become private inspectors general to oversee the management of this executive agency.
So this is why everything here is sort of fitting together, right? Because if the class is, let's just take, for example, your statement just now that there are 500,000 members of the class and that the order requires re-adjudication with respect to all of them, and okay, let's just take that world. The certification and appointment of counsel to represent a class actually does put them in a different position than, for example, in Cleary. And inquiry, whether Cleary has the remains to have the heft after the limited remand order in SCORE,
right?
I mean, that was a dispute, obviously, there. But my point being is that if we've appointed class counsel and it does represent 500,000 people, and let's just take it, your reading of what we said in this case to be correct, that they're all required to be re-adjudicated and all of that, I mean, class counsel is going to have to work with you. I mean, we could issue a new order that says, you know, meet and talk about this, and but I would hope that we could just say meet and talk about this, because figuring out what you can agree on to do and those pieces that are open where you can't would be really, I think, important. And it also goes to the harm that you, the secretary says, that they would befall, right? Because potentially some of the harm that you've identified, you can fix yourself by dealing with the council. So I was struck that the parties hadn't been able to sit down and at least say, these are the things we can agree on and these are the things we can't.
I think the key distinction here is that in district court litigation, when class counsel is appointed, that means that they represent all the members of the class without having to have a fee agreement or some sort of representation agreement with each one. The court made that decision on their behalf. It doesn't mean, however, that in ordinary district court class litigation, class counsel somehow get involved in the remedial process. When class counsel sue,
Actually, class counsel are most involved in remedial issues, because it's almost, I did a lot of class actions, and I'll tell you, I never tried a class action, because they almost never try, but I certainly did a lot of management of classes. Now, I was on the defense side of things, that's where the rubber hits the road is remedial stuff.
It can be, but I litigated class actions on the plaintiff side, and I can promise you that no defense counsel ever called me for my views on how they should make changes to their procedures. For example, they used to do Fair Debt Collection Practices Act litigation that not only involved the payment of money and damages, but you also had to reform the debt collectors.
Notice and stuff.
Yeah, notices and telephone calls. They never asked us to look at their standard operating procedures to see if they complied. If we found out that they didn't by the representation of our clients or through some sort of discovery mechanism, then we would have a motion to enforce the judgment, or in this court it would be a writ. But there was never, by virtue of being appointed class counsel, a window into the operation of the defendant. And in this case, it's an executive agency with 450,000 employees. This is a big ship, and I don't think that, based on the proposals that we have seen in their version of the corrective action plan 2, that they're bringing much to the table that's going to inform our institutional knowledge. That said, we remain open to, of course, an order to discuss, and we will do it quickly.
Judge,
I'm good.
Anything else?
Your Honor, I would just briefly conclude by saying that the Secretary is not asking you to reconsider your decision today. Instead, all you have to decide today is whether there is sufficient ground for a meaningful and immediate appeal to the Federal Circuit, and whether the prejudice the Secretary faces counsels in favor of maintaining the status quo during the appeal.
Thank you very much. You're reserving 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
All right. We'll hear from the petitioner's counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Mark Blocker on behalf of a certified class in this case. Judges, with your permission, I'd like to start with the two questions that Judge Allen asked, and start with the one at the end about whether there ought to be negotiations between the class counsel and the VA about the terms of the proposed plan. I understand that the plan and our objections to the plan are not before the court this morning, but when you read the objections that we submitted, you'll see that we did ask before, well before the 45 days had expired, for the VA to sit down with us and try to negotiate a plan precisely so that we could avoid having.
And did they?
They did not.
Did they refuse?
They refused to do that. They did not take us up on that.
What was the good faith basis for their refusal?
You'll have to ask Mr. Bader.
They didn't give you any?
They did not. I don't recall, your Judge Greenberg, that they gave us any particular reason. But
all right, go ahead.
Now a certified class, it didn't make sense to us that rather than having the parties submit briefs and have objections and misunderstand each other through pleadings, which is, you know, the bluntest of tools. We did think it made sense to sit down and come up with a plan that was consensual that we could jointly submit to the court for approval, because that's the easiest for Your Honor. The parties can think it through and then give something to Your Honor. So we did try to do that. The fact that we're in the state that we're in is only because that never took place. But I think, you know, it would be appropriate for the court to order that to happen, or at least I think the VA heard your comments today and probably would be willing.
That's
what I think ought to happen.
What was the time frame in which we should order it if we were to adopt your recommendation? Sit down and discuss it within 10 days, 15 days?
Yeah, or at least begin the discussions, because if Mr. Bader is correct that we don't understand something about the internal workings of the agency or we need some additional information, the best way to do that is through some sort of telephonic or face-to-face meeting where we can get together and understand what the issues are and they can learn what our concerns are, and you know, we now represent all the people in the certified class.
And that is entirely consistent, I assume, with your experience. Sounds like it is with my experience with class actions in Article III courts.
Right. What generally would happen in a district court litigation where the plaintiff's counsel is seeking class certification is if a class is certified, there's usually a request for a class list, and then there's a class notice of the sort Judge Allen described that isn't like the one you have here, but describes the lawsuit and gives parties, unnamed class members, an opportunity to opt out. But usually what the plaintiff's lawyers will do is they will run their by the defense lawyers first to make sure there's no objections, because in an ideal world, you want to present, you know, this is an agreed notice to the class. That way, rather than having to litigate those issues before the court really expects the parties are going to work out the terms of the notice. Does that always work out so that there's always a consensual notice? No. I've had situations where, you know, we object to this term being in the notice, or the plaintiffs want this term being in the notice, and some usually on the defense side. But at the end of the day, most times it can get worked out. So that's generally how it works. And it isn't a matter, like Mr. Bader said, of inserting us as private inspector generals. We're not trying to do that. We're trying to represent the people we represent, which is now the certified class. But I also want to go back to the question that Judge Allen asked before about, you know, essentially tell us how to do this in these unique circumstances. And we did try to lay out in our motion, in our response to the Secretary's motion, what we think is the appropriate steps to take here in terms of issuance of judgment. We do oppose entry of a final judgment at this stage. We do understand that ultimately the Secretary may appeal to the Federal Circuit.
What's left here other than compliance, though?
Well, there's two things. First of all, this court ordered a plan to be submitted to the court, and that the plan ought to be formulated, submitted to the court, and approved before this case gets wrapped up and sent to the Federal Circuit or before judgment gets entered. The other thing that we think should happen, which we recently filed, is we filed a motion seeking access to a list of the class members so that we can fulfill our duties as class counsel. We think those two things can be...
Isn't at least the latter of those two just a compliance issue? And if
I think Judge Falvey, you could regard the delivery of a class list as a compliance function. But given that, I think as a prudential matter, since we're so close to getting those two issues resolved, or maybe we can make them part and parcel of the same thing, I think as a prudential matter, it's easier just to wrap it all up, have this court finish its work, and then enter a final judgment, and then allow the Secretary to proceed. Because otherwise, what you get is, if there are going to be disputes relating to what happens either in the formulation of the plan or about giving us access to the class list, if there's going to be a separate appeal from that, why have that separate? Let's just wrap the whole package up. And
In your judgment, in your experience, the class action attorney and all, when are we going to get to that point? I mean, is it going to be soon? Is it going to be 6 months from now, 2 years from now? I mean, what? They've got, you wouldn't deny they've got a right to appeal, right?
I said that already. I don't deny.
Yeah. So, a right that's not allowed to be timely exercised is no right at all, right?
I don't disagree with that.
So when are we going to get there in your judgment?
Okay. So as I said, we think if we could sit down with the secretary, formulate a plan, and come up with a means for us to have access to a class list, I don't understand why that couldn't be done in an expeditious fashion. And we offered to do that, as I said, back in October after this court had issued its order. So precisely so we could avoid any delays, we could get this all wrapped up.
So they sit down this afternoon with you, we could get it wrapped up.
Or
you don't agree, and then you come back to us and we decide.
Correct. But at least we would tee up that dispute, but we would narrow whatever the disputes are to whatever our legitimate disputes.
And thus avoiding fragmented litigation.
Correct.
So basically, my point was going to be exactly the same as Judge Falvey, and because...
It's good we're channeling each other.
Absolutely, right? I'm off.
Well, no, and I'm with him on this so far.
But so I think February 2nd, give or take, is when something is due about the information, right? And I might be making that date up, but I'm not off by orders of magnitude, right? So that is going to be briefed. I would hope that we'd be able to come to an agreement with that. I know we had the same fight in the Godsey case, but so there's that. And then there's the notice plan. So assume in a world in which within a period, and I'm going to ask Mr. Bader this too, right? This is actually probably more for Mr. Bader, but in a world in which hypothetically we were able to either get resolution on these issues or provide resolution ourselves within 60 days, you know, so we're talking mid-March. At that point in time, your view would be we could enter a judgment, and if there were only enforcement issues left, whether we did it by the writ device or some other mechanism, those enforcement things would still be able to go on here, because once the plan of notice was in place and the information issue was resolved, all that's left is somebody coming to us and saying, I need relief from judgment, if it's the secretary, or you coming and saying, they're not following the order. And that would be something we'd retain jurisdiction in those situations to do, either through the writ or something else.
I can't say it better than you just said. That seems like a reasonable plan to me, which is to, within 60 days, wrap up all these remaining issues, and then you can enter judgment. If there are execution issues that need to be resolved, we can come to this court, but the secretary then can take an appeal, but all the other mechanisms can move forward in the meantime. I never fully answered Judge Valley's question, though. In the typical district court litigation, the reason this is somewhat unique is the court generally doesn't decide the merits and class certification at the same time. So generally, once certification is decided, the case goes on right in the district court. There's a right under Rule 23-F to do a permissive appeal, which is very rarely granted. But then, otherwise, there's no right of appeal until basically everything else is wrapped up in the district court, you know, either by settlement or judgment, judgment, whatever it is, and then it goes to the appellate court. It's really the same process we're asking for here, because this court's order said that the secretary was to submit a plan, and we had hoped to make that, as I said, a conceptual plan. So I think as a prudential matter, and I think I hear all three judges saying this, it does make sense to wrap all this up and enter a final judgment, and then the secretary can appeal. I agree with Judge Allen's comment that, you know, interlocutory appeal here is a very poor substitute for what the secretary wants to do. We should hammer out the remaining details and then...
All right, so what's the time frame again that you're content with, 60 days?
I think we'd be fine with 60 days.
All right. What about the secretary? What's your position on this proposal? 60 days, you will have met, and you will have submitted an agreed-upon plan. Or at the end of 60 days of good faith back and forth negotiations, you cannot agree, and you tell us.
Your Honor, we'd be happy to meet within 60 days.
No, during the 60-day period, I think is the proposal.
Yes.
That we get the agreed-upon plan no later than 60 days.
I have a few points that I would like to discuss that I think are roadblocks to us coming to an agreement, but we remain open to having those negotiations, and if you want to set a 60-day deadline to file what you can agree upon and identify what you can't, we'd be happy to do that. I don't want to take more, Mr. Walker.
You're not taking his time. Thanks.
Yeah, I often wonder why we have a clock in this room anyway, so that's okay.
So I think a 60-day time period would be fine. I think whatever Mr. Bader's going to argue about in rebuttal that are the whatever obstacles he sees to doing that, that's exactly why there should be discussion. You know, if there are legitimate things that we need to take into account, we'll take them into account, but we ought to have discussion with the Secretary.
So, yeah, because so for me, I suspect there are, I've been surprised in my life before. So maybe all of a sudden you both submit something that is, you say we've agreed on absolutely everything. I suspect that won't happen. But my point is, I really am trying to balance the need for us to finish what we need to do in terms of a management with allowing the Secretary the ability to meaningfully afford his right to appeal. That's what I'm balancing, because Judge Falvey's right. If the answer was no, this is going to go on for 2 years, well, then we've got the hard question of how do we make it work. If we can set up, you know, our, not to channel the Chief Justice who's busy on other matters now, but, you know, we'll make the balls and strikes call, right? But we got to get you folks to pitch the ball, because we can't make a call. So you pitch, hopefully you'll agree on a lot. If you can't, then we resolve to move quickly to answer those rightly or wrongly, and then, okay, we've just got enforcement and the Secretary appeals. And I pick 60 days figuring that, you know, in the appellate world, probably the world isn't going to end between now and mid-March if we're able to do that. And if the Secretary wants to move faster, I'm sure you will too.
Yes.
So.
2 points about that, Judge. Even if we don't come to a complete agreement, what it will help the court with is we will certainly narrow the disputes if nothing else. Or I would hope we would be able to narrow the disputes. So that's item number one. And item number two, we are, in our response, we are not taking the position that, you know, we are trying to block the Secretary from appealing. We understand the Secretary may appeal. Maybe this time they'll proceed with the appeal. But we understand that they have the opportunity to appeal. We are not trying to block that, but we are trying to be in a position where everything's wrapped up and we aren't doing things back and forth between the Federal Circuit and this court. So I don't have any other comments unless your honors have any other questions.
What were your thoughts on the inadvertent error in the order on the temporal limits?
Well, I'm not going to say it's an error. It was the court's order. The Secretary is quite right that it is not the precise class that we asked for, but it does make sense why Your Honor's ordered, because there certainly would be people going back in time who would have legitimate claims, and there's nothing wrong with the class definition the way that you crafted it.
Would you be comfortable with us going to the limits, the time limits you put in?
I honestly had not given that a lot of thought, Judge Falvey, and I think what makes more sense is before the Secretary files another motion related to that. Again, we can talk about that with the Secretary as well. But keep in mind, I'm in a difficult position here because I represent a certified class of individuals who the Secretary is now asking to cut out, so I'm not just going to agree on the spot that some of the people that are in the certified class should be cut out, but we're willing to listen to what the Secretary has to say about whether there should be an amendment. But there's nothing wrong with the definition of the class the way it is, and it's it may be better than the one that we proposed, and frankly, if you look at the class certification case law, you'll see it's not infrequent, and it happens all the time that the court will certify a class different than the one that they classified.
And so it would be at least theoretically possible as part of the discussions between the class and the Secretary to think about whether the plan of notice could address this issue in a certain respect. In other words, I'm sort of thinking about, this is an imperfect analogy, but in this court for a while our 120-day appeal deadline was non-jurisdictional, and then for a period of time it was magically jurisdictional, and then it became non-jurisdictional again. And after the Supreme Court's case, you know, we allowed people to file motions, essentially, to seek the benefit of equitable tolling that was denied during a period of time. I'm not suggesting that is the approach that could be taken, but it seems to me that might be a different way to do this than saying go back, reopen everybody's claims, even if you don't know that they want it reopened, right? I mean, so in other words, that could be part of something that's on the table, just as a suggestion.
Happy to take that into account, Judge. The other thing I would say, and I did want to spend a few minutes on the motion to stay precedential effects, but I want to point out, Your Honor said that the question about whether to amend the class definition does have bearing here, but it definitely has bearing on the Secretary's request for stay in precedential effect, because the only irreparable harm, so of the four factors, and I'll go through them in a second, but of the four factors, the only irreparable harm that they identified is the need to go back beyond the class that we had asked for. They're not saying there's irreparable harm to the Secretary from just doing what we asked them to do. Their only irreparable harm would go away if the class definitions were revised in the way that they had suggested it be revised. But I just want to briefly touch on the motion to stay precedential effect, which unfortunately there isn't going to be any negotiation on that one. We do oppose that motion. And there are, as you know, four factors. It seems to me that two of the factors are really easy to deal with and unquestionably favor the certified class. One is the irreparable harm. Even if the class definition isn't amended, the Secretary hasn't given you any proof whatsoever about what sort of burden this would be to go back and look at older claims. And that is the only irreparable harm that they identify. But without, it's their burden to provide proof. They can't just come in and say it's going to be hard to do. And having not given you any proof, that element sways in favor of the certified class.
In fact, our rules require it, right? Relate
requires it, that they provide affidavits or other evidence on contested matters. So, yeah, so they haven't provided anything. And I would just point out, to answer something Judge Greenberg pointed out at the very beginning, when they did move for a stay of presidential effect in the Stop case, they did present some evidence. This time they didn't present any evidence. So that factor unquestionably weighs in favor of the certified class. The other one that is clearly in our favor is the impact on the non-movement. Not only have they not put in any evidence, I think in the brief it's all one paragraph, but not only have they not put in any evidence, but we put in counter evidence from a select group of class members showing the real impact to class members from delaying the precedential effect of this decision. So those two are easy. The only ones...
There are real impacts, there's no doubt about that, but I am concerned about the requirement that if they prevail at the Federal Circuit, that any distributions will have to be clawed back.
If that's going to be sufficient on its own, Judge Valby, then any time money is going to have to come out of the fisc, you're always going to be granting a stay of precedential effect. But we don't really have any idea how fast or quickly claims will be adjudicated. And the answer to that concern is, if the Secretary is really worried about that, and I don't hear them saying that in their briefs, that they are worried about that, but if they are worried, when they get to the Federal Circuit, they can explain that they need to expedite the appeal for precisely that reason. And I'm not sure we would...
Or seek a stay there?
Or they could seek a stay there, I suppose. More importantly, I think it would be denied there as well, but if... Even if it were denied, they could ask the court to expedite the appeal so that the rules can be pitched very quickly, and I'm not sure that we would oppose them.
Do you agree with the legal principle that that there would be a requirement to claw back?
I have to be honest, Judge Allen, I haven't looked hard enough at that. I know that there is a regulation that would allow that, or I'm not sure if it's allow or require, but I don't know what the Secretary's view would be. But keep in mind, you need to balance the harms here. Some of the people that we submitted affidavits from, their claims are from 2016, 2015, you know, these are old claims to begin with. These are people who had real consequences from the fact that they haven't been reimbursed entirely for the amounts that they're owed. They have real-life consequences. So as between that and the Secretary saying we might make some payments that, you know, we might not have had to pay if the rule was established right away, that doesn't strike me as the balance of harms tipping in favor.
So, yeah, and sort of that's a separate sort of in the balancing equation, but you know, it is a an intellectually an intellectually difficult thing, right? So prior to our decision, you know, what the law was, you can ask sort of the brooding omnipresence in the sky sort of thing, right? But once we said in September, this is what the law is, and from Mr. Bader's presentation, it seems like the Secretary is then complying with what the law is. He's asking, stop, you know, don't make us keep doing this right now, but right now they seem to be adjudicating this. It seems to me an odd thing that then if later a court says, nope, you were wrong, that somehow then the agency that was complying with the law that existed at the time, as we said it was, will go to the men and women who fought for the United States and make them take money out of their pockets. That just seems like an odd thing if the law were going to actually require that. It seems inconsistent with sort of what Congress would have meant, I think.
I agree with that.
And by the way, just before you get too far into this abstraction, they've had regulations for years where they have mistakenly or wrongly paid a veteran, an individual case. They've overpaid or they made a mistake in the effective date or whatever it is, and there's a whole regulation, a whole regulatory process about how they go about changing the payment or getting the money back. So they're used to dealing with this. I don't, even if that were to become an issue, they're not strangers to this concept of, gee, we made a mistake, or we paid in accordance with the ruling of the Veterans Court, and now we've got the Federal Circuit saying another thing. And by the way, maybe the Supreme Court will agree with us. See Henderson, for example. What happened there?
And I agree with you, Judge Greenberg, and I would hope that in the unlikely event that this were to go to the Federal Circuit and somehow get reversed, but there were payments in the interim, I would hope that the Secretary would not be interested in clawing those back, having made some of these people wait for a really long time to have their claims adjudicated. And frankly, in the context of a very overburdened agency, not spending their time and money to get money back from the people who fought for our country. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. I don't think that should factor into the equation here, because otherwise that would be the Secretary's trump card to stay the presidential effect every single time. Here we put in counter evidence that there is real harm to the veterans who, whose claims are being delayed or improperly denied. And so to me, the balance of harms here tips in favor of the certified class. There's two other factors I just want to briefly touch on. One is obviously likelihood of success. I understand that the members of the panel are probably going to disagree on the Secretary's likelihood of success, but let me say this. I don't think they satisfy the factor for the reasons they set forth in the brief, because at the end of the day, what the Secretary is really saying, they've admitted now, they're really saying is, Congress passed a law that did not make any change in the law. In other words, they meant to make it so that insured veterans would be treated equally with uninsured veterans, but they did it in such a way that veterans actually got no money whatsoever. And one of their reasons, they actually said that, unfortunately, that's the result. I don't think that is going to, it didn't apply to this court, it is not going to apply to the Federal Circuit, and it's not as if this is an issue of first impression. This is the second time that this issue has come before this court. It came before this court. Stop and lost, came before this court. In this case, they lost. This is not an issue of first impression, so their satisfaction of the likelihood of success, they haven't satisfied that. That's another factor that tips in favor of denying the motion to stay presidential effect. And the last factor is the public interest. And only claim of public interest here in the Secretary of Brief is in re-adjudicating claims. That's what they're saying. You know, if we have to go back and re-adjudicate these claims, we're going to waste the agency's time and money. But at the end of the day, when a veteran goes in for an episode of emergency care, they have to adjudicate the claim anyway. They have to figure out what they're going to pay. The only thing they have to do that's different under the honor's order in this case is they have to figure out how much is deductibles, how much is co-pays, and how much is co-insurance, and two of those now have to be paid. We're not talking about a mammoth undertaking to do that. And again, to pick up on Judge Falvey's point, if it really was a difficult undertaking, they should have put in some evidence explaining why it is. But to me, as a logical matter, it shouldn't be very difficult. They adjudicate this now, figure out what's co-insurance and deductibles, and not pay it. So if all they're doing now, the only difference is they're flipping the switch and paying the claim. So the public interest doesn't even favor a stay of precedential effect, and so the court ought not to grant one. And I know at the end of the day, this isn't a numerical balancing test. It isn't, three factors favor Russell, one favors the secretary. But when you do the totality of circumstances that Rubato requires you to do, I think there's absolutely no question that this court should deny a stay of precedential effect. So that was all I had, judges, unless there's any other questions.
Judge Falvey. Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think I'd like to start with the motion to stay. Obviously, whatever the court sees fit to direct us to do with respect to working out, getting to a judgment, which I think we're all interested in doing, there are going to be disagreements that we have, and we can try to work them out, and then we can tee them up for your decision later. But I think that no matter what happens, we need to focus on the fact that the stay is warranted in the interim.
Could you address specifically the point about that Mr. Blocker and Judge Falvey were talking about, which is the failure to submit evidentiary support?
I was somewhat confused by that, Your Honor. We submitted the declaration of Dr. Cameron Matthews in October, which explained to you not only what it would take to provide notice to the former members of the working class, but also set out separately an outline of what we would need to do to effectuate relief for the Wolf class. Now, that was not required by your order, but we wanted to show you in good faith that we're thinking about how we would do this. It was not a small matter. I mean, one of the things you have to appreciate is that prior to your September 9th decision, we had no obligation to track any information about cost sharing, that is to cut it up into pieces. And insurance companies are different, but very often they code it as something called patient responsibility. Whatever it is, we're not going to pay it because it's a deductible, co-insurance, co-pay. So it is, right now, an entirely manual process to figure out, looking at individual explanations of benefits from various providers, what those amounts are going to be. It is not flipping a switch. There is no automated system to do this yet. We're working to develop one, as we told you, but it is not in place yet. And going back in time, it will be almost impossible.
So just to be precise, I'm taking no position on this because I haven't thought about it. Your position is the Secretary complied with Rule 8's requirement to submit evidentiary support for its motion based on essentially the incorporation of evidentiary support that was made with response to the submission about a plan of notice?
Yes.
Okay.
And, it's not as though the Secretary pulled out of thin air the numbers about 500,000 affected veterans or millions of claims. You saw that in response to your May 31st order. So the
point is then you are basically saying, whether there was strict compliance, to go to other areas of the law, it was substantial compliance with Rule 8 because of the evidentiary support that had been submitted along the way that you would say would line up with any evidentiary assertions made in this particular motion.
I think so, and given the fact that our motions are limited by rule to 10 pages and the fact that this court is intimately familiar with the facts of the case over the years that we've spent together working on it, it didn't even cross my mind to make additional evidentiary submissions that would be largely identical. So if there's a moment for Rule 2 to come into operation, I think that Rule 8 should not stand as a barrier to the evidence that is already in your record. I'd also like to respond to a couple of points Mr. Blocker made about the propriety of this day. One of the points that he brought up that I think is important to appreciate is the effect on VA, the potential prejudice. He said, other than having to go back and open claims, there is no prejudice. Well, as I just explained to you, for the prospective piece of doing these adjudications consistent with Wolf, there is still a huge amount of work that needs to be done and a very large ship that needs to turn to begin to process these claims.
But does that, on that point, does that, so when we're looking at, in the injunction context, right, and you're looking at a permanent injunction, you're looking at the harm that goes out ad infinitum. It goes forever, right, because it's a final judgment. When you're looking at harm in the context of preliminary injunctions, which this would be an equivalent to, right, because you're staying the precedential effect until the Federal Circuit does something, you're not looking out into the future forever. You're looking out at a defined period of time, right? You're looking at a point until the Federal Circuit makes a decision. So that's actually, I actually think, where you might run into, and I have not fully considered this, so I'm not taking a position, but where you might run into the Roulette issue. Because arguably there's support in the record for the harm over time, 500,000 people, and this is all we would have to do to comply with this going out into the future. But there's nothing that I can point to as an evidentiary matter that says, here's the standard amount of time that an appeal would take at the Federal Circuit, and in that period of time, this is the harm that would befall the agency, because that's the only time that matters in terms of the harm here. It's just that time.
I agree with you, Your Honor, but I think you have the evidence you need. I honestly do. I think that when you compare the numbers that we provided about the numbers of claims that we're processing per quarter that we provided to you last year, and look at Dr. Matthews' declaration and see the kinds of fundamental system changes that we would have to provide, changing our IT systems just to record this information, then developing standard operating procedures to be able to adjudicate the claims and training people how to do it.
So, but how about this? So I take it you're, as Theodore Roosevelt would say, you're sort of, you're bullish on your chance at the Federal Circuit, right? Then why say that, then why isn't all of that harm self-inflicted? Meaning, if you are so certain you're going to win within 18 months, assuming we get the judgment out the door, then why not make an interim approach for the 18 months as opposed to saying, let's now build a great, fancy ship?
Your Honor, the ship is already moving, and it needs to start turning now if it's going to make the changes that it needs to make. We weren't just showing this to make you happy. As I told you earlier, we don't have a stay of your ruling unless and until we get one, and anticipating that a judgment will soon issue, then we need to be ready to comply. And so I don't think there's a way for us to adopt that approach, and it's not for me to step on VHA's, sort of institutional experience in doing this to tell them how they're going to do.
If I could ask one last question.
Sure.
What is the Secretary's position about recoupment?
It is possible for the Secretary, pursuant to its regulations, to recoup. It's also possible for him to waive any overpayments that have been made. I would say that in this case, it's a difficult decision, because if time goes on and many hundreds of thousands of claims or hundreds of thousands of veterans with millions of claims are paid, the outlay is going to be substantial on VA's part. We're prepared to pay consistent with the law, Mr. Staub.
Are you, and when I say mean you, I mean the department, is are you telling veterans that the payments that they're getting under Wolf now, in terms of the adjudication under Wolf's, come with a potential string attached to them, or are you just relying on their normal, the legal fiction that everybody knows the law?
The second, Your Honor, and I want to be very clear. As far as I'm aware today, we have not actually re-adjudicated any particular claim going forward, but we are in the process of completing the IT changes and doing the trainings that we need to start.
But I had understood you at the beginning to say that not re-adjudication, but if somebody submits a claim today to the St. Petersburg Regional Office and they have a deductible, you're going to pay under Wolf.
We will, but I mean for those adjudicated, I mean that still has to go through an adjudicative process, and we have not started doing those prospective adjudicators.
Why not?
Because there were system changes that we had.
So okay, now I'm very, very confused as to what you said at the beginning, because I was actually very, I was very impressed that you started out in part of your argument and said, we're complying with the law. Right now, saying that we fully intend to maybe want to comply with the law once we get a system in place is not the same thing as saying you're writing people checks. So we issued a decision, you know, whatever, 4 months ago, and in that period of time, nobody in the VA system has been paid a deductible or co-insurance.
I don't know that they haven't been, but I can't represent to you that they have. This is something that actually concerned me greatly when you issued the order for argument, and I did a lot of digging to figure out what we were doing to get ready. So, you know, we have Dr. Matthews.
So you mean to get ready?
To start doing education.
So... okay, I'm having some difficulty. I understand the idea that for claims that are in the past, right, meaning that, say, had been denied, that may have to go back, and we've got to figure that out, okay? But when James Smith today submits a bill, and it says, you know, deductible, $250, okay? It seems to me that now the VA's position is, we know we need to pay that because Wolf said it. We disagree, but we know we need to pay it. We will comply, but we're not going to write a check until when?
Oh, not at all, Your Honor. I don't mean to suggest that we are holding any part of the process. I'm just saying that the system changes that we need to undertake, like reforming our IT, providing training, those sorts of things didn't happen on September 9th, and so we are working to get that done.
So do we have a timeline for when? Because I know, you know, it's funny, we've been looking at the timeline the other way, right, saying a timeline that gets the Secretary to the Federal Circuit, and I appreciate that. But it took, what, a couple of years, I think, for 18 months at least, for regulations to come out in Mr. Staub's situation. And in that time, nothing happened.
I can represent to you that we don't anticipate needing to make regulations right away. As we told you in Dr. Matthews' declaration, we think that we can adjudicate most of these claims under our existing regulations. There may be a problem where the deductible or coinsurance exceeds 70% of what Medicare would pay for that service because we have a separate limitation, but that's something we might need to regulate around, but in the vast majority of cases, that won't happen. I can represent to you that we continue to work on all of those items that are listed in Dr. Matthews' declaration. We think that we can get something like an IT system built that would automate this process going forward by the late summer, and that we already have a pilot office ready to start adjudicating these claims based on standard operating.
So let me just ask a question. I may be now missing something totally. Why in the world, then, do you need a stay of precedential effect? It sounds like you're not going to do anything other than build the system.
Your Honor, it was not possible for us to comply with your order on the day it was issued. We're doing everything...
No. I understand that, but it sounds to me like the timeline is what you just said. You hope, VA hopes to have the system built by the end of the summer, okay? That sounds to me like basically a year after we issued the decision in Wolf, give or take some small period of time, right? Which means that you won't even begin then to start bearing any of the actual out-of-pocket costs of writing a check, if you will, until that time. Right, so why the urgency then with the stay of precedential effect, particularly if we can get a judgment done, you know, in 90 days or something from today or something?
Your Honor, the close of my statement was going to be that we've already designated a pilot office to start working out the standard operating procedures. We've developed a base training manual to try to figure out how to do these adjudications, and that's set to start next month. So there's a system that we're creating to try to automate it because it's a very cumbersome system, as we can all appreciate at this point. That automation is separate. We are going to start these adjudications very soon. So the stay of precedential effect is not only because we're going to start doing this, but that without a stay, we have to keep complying throughout the life of the appeal. So I apologize if I didn't speak clearly enough before, but I do appreciate those questions, and I want you to understand that we are making every effort to turn this large ship to do these adjudications. It took some time, but we're moving very quickly to start actually putting payments out the door as soon as next month. Your Honors, I think that's the close of my time. So what I would say in...
Keep going. Take whatever time you need.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have that much more to add, except that I think one of the most important things I can respond to from what Mr. Blocker said is this idea that the prejudice that we're going to suffer is just going back in time. One of the things I'm not emphasizing to you, and you won't read it in the brief that I wrote, is that I feel prejudiced by having to pay this money. You have interpreted the ECFA to say that we are going to pay co-insurance deductibles. I'm not prejudiced by your reading of the law. What I'm trying to point out in this motion is that we are prejudiced by having to do all these system changes so that even if we have a recoupment available, we can't ask anybody to recoup the cost of changing IT systems, developing new training.
Just a minute. What do you have to do? Why don't you explain to me what you have to do with these big IT changes? Ms. Jones comes in to the... What's your pilot office? Where's that?
The BISN-5.
Where's that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know where it's located.
Why not? Isn't that a... Ms. Jones comes in to a very busy office, let's say New York City, or a less busy office, wherever that might be. Here's my bill from the hospital. I got a Wolf decision here. I got a bill from the hospital here for my emergency room stay. I want you to pay it. What do you need? You've got clerks in every regional office that make decisions day in and day out in accordance with the guidance, which you say is being put together. What more does a clerk in the regional office need to at least make an effort to say, Ms. Jones, I don't think you got a Wolf case payment here? Or, yeah, sure, emergency room stay, $100,000. $48,000, as in Staub. You haven't paid that, have you?
No.
No, and this is 2020. That decision was April 2016, and the secretary withdrew his appeal in June of 2016. So what are we supposed to do here? Are we supposed to believe that the secretary is actually acting in good faith based upon your representations, that you're putting together this construct? What happens when, answer that, when Ms. Jones comes into a regional office and says, here's my bill from the hospital for my emergency room, and I'll add to that, I'm 80, and I might die. What's your clerk in the regional office going to do with that now?
Your Honor, we have to adjudicate the claims in the order we receive them, and one thing that we can take away from the ECFA is that it's extremely complicated. There are a huge number of regulations that go in to decide what we can pay. But to answer your question quite simply, if she came into, it's an Office of Community Care that actually adjudicates these, are part of EHA, not VBA. But if she came into an Office of Community Care with a hospital bill and the Wolf decision and said, I'm part of the class, please pay my deductible.
No, she doesn't say I'm part of the class. She says, I am a litigant, a potential litigant. I'm entitled to what the Congress said in December 2009 in passing this statute.
If she has other health insurance, we can't know what we can pay until we go get the explanation of benefits from the other.
She says, here's my bill. This is what they're demanding I pay. I don't have anybody else paying it. That's what, I'm a veteran. This is what they're demanding I pay. And I got the Wolf decision and an act of Congress from 2009. Pay it. What does your clerk say? What more does he need?
the explanation of benefits that says what the primary insurance paid. If we don't know what they paid, then a hospital bill is not very meaningful to us because the primary insurance will have paid something.
But could I just reframe this, because I understand that you're answering precisely the question that Judge Greenberg asked. But let's clear this away, okay? Assume that the community care office has all of the documents, okay? So it is the person who, you have the explanation of benefits, you have the bill. I think Judge Greenberg's fundamental question, it was the same one that mine is. If that person today has all of that in the community care office in front of the adjudicative officer, okay? What does that person do?
They submit the claim and then we would pay it.
So you
that would take, because I don't know how much work each office has. I mean, they have a stream of claims that they need to process.
Yes, and I understand. I guess what I'm going at is, listen, this is, at least for me, it's a very simple question. By the way, I've appreciated both of your arguments today. They've actually been very helpful. This is not a criticism, but right now, don't worry about the, we have to do things in order, and they need an explanation of benefits. Those are all true. The point is, not to put too fine a point on it, is this a situation like post-stop, where it turned out that for the two-year period, VA said, we are writing regulations, which meant nobody's claim ever could be paid because you were waiting for the regulations? Or is the situation now, yep, we're working on IT, yep, we're working on standard operating procedures, but if somebody comes in and we've got all the evidence we need, in the normal order, we will then pay the claim, even though those other things aren't done? Or are you waiting for something else to start?
I don't believe we are waiting for anything else to start.
And so do you feel comfortable, because I trust you, you've appeared here a number of times, okay? So do you feel comfortable making a public representation that that's the case? Because if you don't, that's okay at this moment as far as I'm concerned, but then I'd want you to go find out from somebody that that's the case. Because clearly, Wolf does not stand for the proposition that the secretary has to pay a claim without having evidence, and it doesn't stand for the proposition, at least standing alone, that you need to go out of order, right? But it does stand for the proposition that when you've got the explanation of benefits that shows a deductible and you've got the evidence and that claim's time comes up, that it gets paid, right? And that's what I think Judge Greenberg and I were both asking.
I do appreciate that question, and I do want to get to the heart of that. What I know today is that we have designated a pilot office to begin processing those claims. I can't say what office that's going to be and what order they're going to start taking the claims in. I really endeavored, understanding that we weren't talking about Corrective Action Plan 2 or the World Class Relief today, but that we were probably going to talk about it, I endeavored to dig and find all the information I could to update you on what we have done. And not only shows that we're acting in good faith, but it also shows you that we need that guidance from the judgment to know exactly what it is we're doing.
So I would be interested in, and I suspect we'll be issuing some sort of order in short course at telling people to do something. How about that for ambiguity? But I'm fairly confident some portion of that is going to be to have a definitive position from the department about, I'm going to call, new claims, right? In other words, just leaving aside the re-adjudication piece, right, which I think may raise different issues, but the claim comes in the door, ready to be done. In the normal course, it would be time to pay the person. It's very important that I know what happens. I sympathize with you in the sense that you're the face of the 400,000 VA, right? And I bet you it was really difficult to figure out what the heck was going on with this, right? And it's not a criticism of the VA, it's just a lot of things going on. But we couldn't make much of a decision here if, in fact, we can't figure it out. And if you can't figure it out being inside, it's going to be hard for us, right? And so without impugning the secretary's good faith, we're not writing on a blank slate, at least for me. We're writing on a slate in which for 2 years nothing was done to comply with a decision because we were writing regulations. And it's very important to me in addressing the motions that we have to know that that's not happening for certain.
Your Honor, I absolutely appreciate that concern, and I'm happy to provide any updates that I can about our processes. But to be clear, I would like to emphasize that the issuance of a judgment, in our view, the invalidity of the regulation has now been established and a judgment can be issued, and a stay can be granted, allowing us to appeal without having to start those adjudications. Pre-judgment compliance with your order, which grants final relief to a party, I don't think should actually affect your decision-making. I don't want to draw your ire. I'm telling you that under Tobler, we know what the law is, and we are endeavoring to do it. But I think, analytically, it's not a factor.
Well, and I appreciate that, and I'm not ired by that. I think this is different ways to look at it, and I'm increasingly, although I've only been doing this job for 2.5 years, I'm increasingly, I understand the real politic of the fact that if you happen to be sitting up here, although you would, my robe would dwarf you, I think, but it's a long robe, you might come to a different conclusion. But I will tell you that right or wrong, my question to you matters to me. And so,
additional information that we can provide. We are endeavoring to turn the ship as you have directed it. We're just asking that you give us the reprieve, but we know until you give it to us, we don't have it. So I think in closing, unless there are further questions, I'd just like to draw your attention back to Roboto 2, which guides your analysis on the stay. Remember, in Roboto 2, the court granted a stay because it recognized that there was going to be substantial prejudice to the secretary based on the Haas decision that was going to extend the presumption of herbicide exposure to over 800,000 new veterans. We're talking about a similar situation here. We've discussed at length the sorts of endeavors we have to undertake. We know that there are 500 or more thousand claimants at issue. There are millions of claims. I think that those issues are the ones that should inform your prejudice analysis. I'm not asking you to say that simply the payment of money is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Judges, I know Mr. Bader borrowed some of my time. Would it be okay if I borrowed 2 minutes of his time just to address the...
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Were you through, Counselor?
I am, Your Honor.
I just want to address two narrow points, because one of the things we've talked about is the Secretary hasn't presented any evidence, and now I'm hearing for the first time today that the evidence is the affidavit from Dr. Matthews. I have two things about that. First of all, when you look at their brief that seeks a stay of precedential effect, you're not going to see a single citation to that affidavit. So I was looking to see if maybe I missed something. Maybe I still did miss something because I just looked at it quickly, but there's no reference. There's nothing that alerted us or you that is the evidence that they're relying on. Second, even if it is the evidence, let's say I'm wrong, somewhere they in a footnote they cited it. When you look at the actual affidavit, you are not going to see factual support for any of the things they say are issues. There's no factual support for how much is it going to cost to go back and re-adjudicate claims, or how much are they going to have to pay, or what they're going to do. There's no time frames whatsoever. All there are, if you look in the affidavit under the section titled Global Corrective Actions, is there's a bunch of statements about what they are thinking about doing or what they're hoping to do. That's not the sort of evidence that ought to justify a motion to stay precedential effect. And I would have been done if Mr. Bader hadn't brought up Roboto 2, but now I feel compelled to point out the difference between Roboto 2 and this case is in Haas, what you were doing is you were taking 800,000 people who had never, weren't going to be claimants, and you were sticking them into the system for the first time. You were giving them a presumption that they were exposed to Agent Orange. That's not what you have here. These people, everybody is going to be in the system that has emergency care. All that we're asking is that, and all that Your Honors have ordered, is that if part of their claim is coinsurance or deductibles, that they're entitled to that amount. And if you look at Dr. Matthews' affidavit, I don't know if it's he or she actually, but the affiant says that they were able to figure out, based solely from looking at the EOBs, whether they think they're going to be able to do this. And that's all they had to look at. So when Mr. Bader says it's going to be difficult, it's going to take a lot of steps, a lot of time to move the ship, this is nothing like Roboto 2. And there's no basis. They haven't satisfied any of the factors and have submitted no support. So a motion to stay precedential effect on me. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll reserve and we'll come down to Greek Council.
All right.